Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namassami. So I had a person who asked me a few hours ago to say something tonight. I warned him that just come back from Europe about a few days ago. I'm still time differences are such that it's 8 hours later in Europe right now. So I'm about 3 o'clock in the morning. 8 and 8. At 4 o'clock in the morning. Just about to wake up. Strange feeling to come back to Abhayagiri, who's at the time of the year, springtime, when everything is kind of blooming and beautiful, and our community has been on retreat, and there's a very nice kind of energy. And then during the winter, I received this email from Ajahn Pasanu, saying that Mary, our dear friend, was poorly, I might not see her when I come back. She was dying. So, kind of contrast between coming back here, feeling the freshness and the energy of spring, and then this kind of experience of death very close by. Someone everybody here loves and feels sad, I imagine. And I certainly feel sad. So it's kind of a mixture of a renewal and this kind of sadness at the same time. We all have these feelings, don't we? Kind of feeling of sadness, feeling of loss, feeling of being depressed or miserable or happy, joyful. And often those feelings have a lot of power. They tend to invade our mind. We don't quite know what to do with them. They kind of project themselves onto things, onto people, onto situation. We try to justify them. We try to. When I was in France, I was with my 90-year-old father, who lives in the south of France. I spent nearly 3 months with him, and I was amazed. Out of the first 6 weeks I spent with him, the feeling of sadness was very also pervasive, just watching one's father, who had been a very buoyant and very active man and very energetic, just sort of little by little, just seeing the body. He has a very good mind. He's not, like he says, he's not suffering from senility yet. His memory is good, and he's got a very, very good brain, very good mind, good memory. But his body is kind of slowly getting closer to the ground. He doesn't walk so well. He doesn't like eating very much food. Not that he was a particularly greedy type of person, but certainly having a good meal was quite an enjoyable experience, and suddenly eating doesn't kind of hold his interest in the way it used to. He doesn't hear so well, he doesn't see so well, so again the senses, the sense faculties are failing slowly. And you can see his world just kind of turning inwards, whether he likes it or not. His world is not so much connecting with the outside, with the outside situation he's part of. And he's more at peace. There was a time when he might have been struggling, trying to hear, trying to understand, trying to be part of a conversation, trying to getting upset if he wasn't, maybe, or impatient, or trying to put some effort into being connecting with his environment, with people. And now the energy is kind of not so powerful, so there is a kind of, you can see there's a tremendous peacefulness in looking at somebody who's of that age, because you know there's just, that's how it is. When you talk about Dhamma and speak about the word Dhamma, it's just what is, and it's a kind of awesome, it's very awesome, because you realize there's nothing you can do about it. And this reality of Dhamma is very much all around us all the time. We just rarely see it. The way our body changes, our body, our mind, from young age, from being a baby to teenager to an adult to growing older, middle age, to old age, there is a kind of, we want to resist, we don't want to look at that, don't we? It's very frightening to imagine that someday we can lose control. Mary next door is only 63. She wasn't prepared to get so close to death a month ago. Even though she had done a lot of practice, she'd grown spiritually for many decades. But I'm sure she was telling me yesterday about her own sadness at leaving all this behind, even though she's ready to go. And it was the same thing with my father, sort of, just this inevitability, the unrelenting kind of movement of time and change and permanence. And so nature has, of course, it's a way of making us all cope with that. You get babies in the springtime and spring, things are kind of flowering and blossoming, and little animals kind of trotting about, and we get feelings of happiness in the springtime. Sort of everybody coming out of winter time, there's a kind of feeling of freshness and joy, just like looking at the flowers and the nature. coming out of its dormant mode, kind of awakening again of nature. This awakening that is preceded by a long winter time, long period of just seemingly lifeless mode. So what really strikes me at this time is how easy it is to get deluded by perceptions, by the way things appear. Like just being with my 90-year-old father, looking at him, he looks really old, sitting kind of bent slightly over. His face is not animated in the way it used to be. His face is relaxed. And like a friend of mine told me, when her face is relaxed, people think she's depressed. So she has to smile from time to time just to kind of cheer up people, because when she just relaxed in herself, people think she's suffering from depression. And I saw my father's face when he's just not engaged with people around him and not hearing what is being said, or he looks really old, very sort of something very kind of rigid about his face, even though it's relaxed. There's something, it's more not, maybe not rigid, but kind of fixity that is kind of remind you of death. Something that, you know, one doesn't want to think about too much. He already looks bit the way probably he'll look on his deathbed. And yet, when you engage and with him, his mind is very bright. He's all there, he's completely alive, but the external seems kind of, you know, almost dead. So reflecting on the body, the way our body are, our bodies, you know, how much energy do we spend in trying to look alive for other people, trying to look animated and interesting and when someone is dying, you know, spending some time yesterday with Mary, it's a strange feeling to see how death and life, life and death and life is so close. In fact, one of my sister's teacher died very suddenly. He was a very fit man, extremely, was a yoga teacher, extremely fit, extremely healthy. And within 3 months he caught something went terribly wrong, and he died very suddenly. And I said, how does it feel to not have him around? And she said, it's very strange, it feels like he's still around, it hasn't gone anywhere. It's kind of feeling of the perception of life and death being so close. One doesn't have that very often. Most of the time it's kind of sense of loss, sense of separation, a feeling of being kind of separated from something, rarely beings give you the impression that life and death is actually not that far away. And those beings are those rare ones who have lived a life by through their own spirit, through their own whose spiritual life was very strong, very active, very powerful, as someone like Mary, who is prepared to be very conscious, to die consciously. It's quite rare. In fact, we're all here. This monastery is a place where we are preparing ourselves to die consciously. Doesn't have to wait for physical death to experience death. Each day, each moment is one of conscious dying, dying to the previous moment, dying to our thoughts, our feelings, our mood, our grasping, our clinging, our cherished obsessions, habits, conditioning. And that's not easy to do. Takes sometimes one wonder what it takes to want to actually let go of each moment. What it takes is just this experience of spaciousness in one's heart. The more one is in touch with the mind, the heart that is not clinging, not grasping to things, to people, to our inner world, and the more, the less we grasp, the more we let go, the more we feel this kind of spaciousness inside, kind of something aired, fresh, cool, open, relaxed, flexible, friendly, connected. The more we feel that within ourselves, the more urgency arises in the heart to let go of that which prevents this ability to be at ease with oneself, to be at peace, to be clear. If most of the time we spend our life in a kind of state of clinging, holding on, and in a kind of clutter of our mind, we get used to that, don't we? We just get used to the sense of ill-at-easeness. We just feel uncomfortable. We don't quite know what to do, but that feels kind of familiar, even though it's uncomfortable. That's all we know. So but it just takes a little, just one moment when we stop, when we start breathing in, breathing out mindfully, when we stop following our the pressures of our mind or the obsessions of our emotions or the relentless kind of demands that our self makes on ourselves, we stop following that and take a look. What is it? What is it that's behind all this? What is it that's behind this kind of clutter, tightness, stress, heaviness in the heart? One takes a look, one looks within oneself, it's not that much really. Seems like almost an impossible thing to shake off sometimes. We wonder where to begin when we feel uncomfortable. We don't know, is that the body? Is there something wrong with my body? Is there something wrong with my mind? Am I being just dissatisfied? Is there something wrong with my job? But if we take a look, it's not that much. It's just taking ourselves very seriously, much too seriously. And if we look closely, all we see is just a lack of space, a lack of ease, a lack of relaxation within oneself. Because when we are relaxed, even stress can be accommodated without any problem. When we approach situations without fear, without anxiety, then even anxiety can be accommodated and fear can be embraced easily. Desire can be embraced easily when there is enough space in ourselves, when there is enough ease. And is talking with Mary yesterday, she was saying how it was, you know, it seemed to be relatively easy for her to contemplate her imminent death. And she said, I'm not really attached to many things, and that makes it a lot easier. And this is really what our practice is leading to, isn't it? To that place where when we are in that situation, we won't be filled with a lot of remorse or worry, unresolved situation. Or relationship. This is really an incentive, isn't it, to live one's life very carefully. Sense of urgency really arises when one sees that death is not just the death of the physical body, it's happening all the time. But because we're not in touch with ourselves, we can't see it. It seems like life, but life is not just, you don't have life without death, you don't have beginning without an ending, you don't have the day without the night, you don't have the winter without spring, or vice versa. It's all, it comes together. In fact, we have in one of our chants, we have this line, days and night are relentlessly passing, how well am I spending my time? Do we ask this question often? How well am I spending my time? Because our personality will know exactly how to make us spend our time, as it's programmed. It has already, it's got its various stations, and it goes down those avenues, knows exactly. Blindly, it goes down its avenues, station number one, number two, number three. But when the Buddha was pointing to this questioning, how well am I spending my time, I don't think he was asking, he was talking to the self, he was talking to the, how well are we awake, how much are we awake throughout our day. What are we doing throughout the day? What is supportive, this wakefulness? What is actually giving strength, life force to this ability to be mindful and aware? And what isn't? Without those reminders, it's very easy to just drift along, to live one's life as if one is immortal, as if one has all the time in the world just to fool around and get distracted from what is really essential in our human life. Very easy to forget. And the self, our personality is the master at forgetting and getting distracted. It has mastered that totally. Not very clever, but it's really good at distracting itself. And it's not something wrong in itself. It's not like it's wrong to get distracted or to forget. But when you see the danger in being unaware, when you see the danger of that, it's quite frightening. Because the more awake you are, the more aware, mindful you are, the more you see the danger of just falling back into habits. And our habits are rooted most of the time. They are good habits, but most of our habits are pretty much rooted in what the Buddha talks, what the Buddha says when in greed, in hatred, in delusion, and the various shades and form of those mental states. One is inclined to sleep, inclined just to eat, to have sex, or to engage in activities which are draining our spiritual heart, not really supportive. We don't know this often unless you spend time alone. When on your own, you realize that you really have to find that inner strength within yourself. You can't really hope for somebody else to do that for you, or to rely on someone else to do the work for you. You have to really find that inner strength to face fear, to face the unknown, because when you're aware and mindful, then you are brought face to face with the unknown. You're not really, you know, you're not prepared to fall back into the known, the habits. And so that's uncomfortable. It's a strange thing that the Buddha talks of suffering and the way out of suffering, but actually being present with in the moment, there is a lot of peace. But also, you know, most people feel that to be face to face with the simplicity of one moment at a time, one little moment. Because in that moment there's a window of truth which is can shake oneself and feel quite shaken when you can just see as it is. So in those moments you may experience sadness, you may experience memories from the past, perception that arise out of nowhere, you wonder why you feel this way at this particular moment. And our task, our responsibility is to keep to let things be as they are, to let things be just as they are. We call this simplicity, but really it's neither simple nor difficult nor completely nor complex. It's just not making more of what is. Just like nature doesn't make a rose more than a rose. It's just a rose. Doesn't turn into something else. When a leaf is finished, it's finished. Just grows and that's it. It doesn't become bigger than it's supposed to be, or it just has its particular shape and form. The sun doesn't get any bigger. The moon goes through its phases, doesn't have a little kind of twiddles and turn into little flowers shaped, or just the moon, it just grows from one circle down to little one line and goes back again. And we are very much the same. We follow the same pattern. We have thoughts, they come up and they arise and they go. We have feelings that arise and go. Perception. And the Buddha kind of carved a path in front of us that can allows us just to have a system by which we can recognize those things. And that's very helpful. Without that, we will be quite lost. We wouldn't know where to begin. So with pain, for example, for me, I've experienced quite a bit of pain the last year, and it's quite new. I don't usually experience a lot of pain, and I notice just leave the pain as it is, it's really quite difficult. Because the mind immediately catches on the pain and makes something more than it is. It doesn't leave it just simple. It doesn't keep things simple. And it's quite all right. The mind just reacts with negativity or with aversion or with repulsion or with sadness or depression or whatever. It kind of tends to react. But if one is just left with a reactive mind that is not allowed to come to an end, then we'll just be stuck for many, many years just in that state of reactivity. With the practice, it's possible to actually let the mind end its reactive patterns. You don't have to go on and on forever. And that requires a lot of mindfulness, because the mindfulness is that very quality of the mind that allows things just to be just the way they are. And when you can see how, when you complicate things, then you can just see it as well, just as it is, complication, proliferation. And when you don't, then you see that too, very simply. So mindfulness is keeps things very simple. See things clearly. But having said that, most of the time we have to really allow the mind just as it is. It's not simple. It's complex, neurotic, always keen to make a story out of nothing, to get judgmental and critical, and and so we have to really give space for that too, because if we don't give space for the mind that is not clear, not simple, not at peace, not present, not friendly, then we'll never really transform it. And that's the suffering of the unsatisfactoriness or the restlessness of the mind is not really transformed. It just keeps going. So after spending 3 months with my family in France, in the most idyllic conditions, most idyllic place, I realized that the Buddha didn't set up certain conditions for nothing, by mistake. You begin to appreciate the monastic environment. not to escape or run away, but it's like a hospital. Monasteries be like a mental hospital. One doesn't want to hear this. Our teacher used to say that, at Insomedo often in the early years, he used to say, this is a psychiatric hospital here. But it's just where we get treated, the heart, this is the place where you treat your heart, where you are reminded of the remedies you need to take, how many times a day you need to take them, how often, how much, how little, how many pills, when you shouldn't take any medications, when you can just drop all your remedies. This is a place where we are reminded what to do with the human heart. And it's not just something we need for 20 years. Those reminders are necessary, I think, till we die, because the mind is such that the momentum of karma, the momentum of force of karma is so strong that unless you had some means and skills to contain that energy, it would just be completely swamped with our own delusion, our own greed, our own silliness. So on Saturday night we come to the hospital, get one shot, get a shot of Dhamma, not in what I'm saying particularly, but maybe just the space, just the silence, the company of people following the path, gets one shot, then goes away again. I'm just greedy. I like to have my shot all the time. So I stay here as often as I can. But even though it's kind of, you know, kind of laugh at these things and say, oh well, what is this, all this business about being a mental hospital? But it is true, one has to be realistic that the human heart needs a lot of support and a lot of help and a lot of reminders. And a space to come in which you feel really the possibilities that possibility of having that enough air to breathe, enough air to think clearly, enough air to feel cool, and to feel the heat of your body, the heat of your passions. You know, enough space, enough silence just to hear what's going on. These are the remedies in practice. And one has to be sensitive with oneself, because sometimes you don't need any remedies. Sometimes the remedies are counteractive. They just oppress the heart. Sometimes you just need to relax, do nothing. Sometimes you need just to go to the beach and enjoy yourself. Sometimes you need to forget about practice. Not as just being forgetful, but just to, as a skillful mean, just to let go of any kind of ideas about how one should be or not be. So it is a fine line. One has to really navigate through these means, through this path, and listen. Really listen very, very carefully. What do I need right now? What is really important? What is meaningful for me right now? Not just blindly follow somebody else's ideas or example, but to have the confidence to come to that place that you can actually know for yourself what is needed, what is the remedy that is needed at each given time. So the practice, sometimes we need to tighten it up when the mind is just inclined to be lazy or careless, sloppy, then maybe one needs to really look into what is needed, what is going to help the mind to be more careful, more alert, more awake. And at other time when you know, the sense of self can arise so strongly in the heart and take hold of the practitioner with a capital T and capital P, and then you start sort of getting enslaved into having to become Moggallana or Sariputta or one of the great arahants of the disciple of the Buddha, or Ayakema, sister came out of the time of the Buddha, in the time of the Buddha. Yeah. So I really loved, once I was reading one of Thomas Merton's book many, many years ago, a long time before I became a nun, called The Seeds of Contemplation, and there was one chapter on integrity, which I really like very much. And in one line he said most people wants to be, I think he was talking about his friends in the monastery, most people are still working really hard. I mean, I'm paraphrasing what he says, it's maybe not the way he wrote it exactly, but he said the people still want to work very hard to become the same that existed 200 years ago, pointing to the fact that becoming a saint was just to be oneself. Rather than to try to emulate somebody that existed several centuries ago. And in fact, Ajahn Sumedho said the same thing, which is a little a teaching that is written down on a piece of wood at what and nailed on a tree at the entrance of Wat Pananachat in Thailand. He says, the point of the practice is not to become a saint, a holy person, but to see the way things are. And the way things are, to know yourself as you are, not as a saint or a sinner or as someone who existed, you know, centuries ago, but just as you are. And sometimes one is sloppy and sometimes one is bright and extremely strong in one's practice, and sometimes one wants to check out the whole thing, and sometimes one feels bright and awake, and the next moment you might feel completely sleepy and bobbing up and down. You know? So just to be able to, or whatever is happening. So there is no conflict between my life and the practice. I don't have to get rid of my life, I don't have to get rid of myself to practice. And I don't have to get rid of the practice to be myself. Because that's often a dilemma that people encounter in their life as practitioners of Dhamma. You know, they practice in order to get rid of themselves, and they want to get rid of the practice in order to be themselves. Sometimes. So it's it can create a lot of pain in people, that attitude. It's like misapprehending the path, trying to become something that one isn't, trying to get rid of somebody who needs to be totally received, or trying to get rid of a mental state or particular emotions or mood that is just waiting just to be acknowledged rather than gotten rid of. So that statement that Thomas Merton was talking about really spoke to me very deeply, that the whole point of walking the path is not to become somebody else, but to just to know oneself just as one is, and to keep the practice, to keep cultivating this a practice that allows you to not be troubled or to be overwhelmed by what you see. Sometimes what you see is not that pretty. You know, even seeing oneself as an arahant is kind of overwhelming too. Occasionally one has this kind of megalomaniac fantasy. When I started my practice in the early years, I used to, during a winter retreat, I was doing walking meditation, and Ashen Sumedho was not very far from me. And every time I look at him, this little voice used to say, "I know he knows that I'm enlightened." I'm glad I had the practice not to go mad with this one. "I know he knows that I'm enlightened. I'm enlightened." And I just heard it, fortunately, just as a simple, just hearing thoughts rather than believing the story. But how many are, you know, so carrying an enlightened one or a deluded one is as burdensome. So, space, silence, is what allows is being in having connection with that mind that is silent and spacious is what allows us to not be totally overwhelmed sometimes by what goes on in it, and to start again each moment, to not ride on the waves of the arising and the passing away of our what we see, what we perceive, what we hear, what we think, but just to allow those waves to come, to arise, and then to move on. This is renunciation. I remember writing down the definition of renunciation by, it was Nisargadatta, I don't know if any of you knows him. He said renunciation is, you know, just not to think twice the same thing. That's renunciation. Not to go through an experience twice. That's renunciation. An interesting way of looking at it. So, some other way we could say that renunciation is the greatest, it's an act of creativity, in the sense that one doesn't recreate twice the same pattern. You let go and then you allow something new to come up. But if you don't let go, then you're still holding on to the old ways. But if you let go, if you renounce, then something new arises, something new comes up. A new way of seeing things, or approaching situations or people. But that takes the ability to let go of the past. So, kind of waking up now more and more. I think I'll leave you on this.